Rashi Radhakrishna Govagovata Sayam Kun Radhakunda Giri Govardhan Kijai Vrindhav Vrindhav Kijai Navadeepdam Kijai Jagat Sami Kijai Manamai Kijai Shimadi Dalasi Devi Kijai Samvidvakta Vrindhi Kijai Gaurav Premananda Hari Kijai. All glory is the assembled devotees, all glory is the assembled devotees, all glory is the assembled devotees. All glories to Shri Guru and Gauranga Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai Gaur Premananda. Okay? So, Om Maganat Vimadandasya Gananjana Shlakaya Chakshurun Minitam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha. So I'm very happy to be here with all the assembled devotees. And I think I was asked as speak with questions and answers, or is the ghosty, or what is the topic for tonight?
Well,
you pick the topic and I can speak about it. Or questions and answers, or whatever.
It would be nice to hear a little bit about the importance of taking shelter of a bona fide spiritual master.
All right. The importance of taking shelter of a bona fide spiritual master. First of all, let's define what a bona fide spiritual master is before you understand what it means to take shelter. So there's several different characteristics which I think you're all aware of, such as coming down in disciplic succession. Let's talk about another topic first, epistemology, before we start talking about that. That's a fancy word for all of you, or some of you. Epistemology means how do we know what we know? And it's a very interesting subject matter. It's a subject matter of studying the science of knowledge. And generally, we know, or we think we know what we know, because we perceive things directly with our senses, or we've heard from others whom we consider to be authorities. So these are actually pretty much faulty methods, because our senses are imperfect, right? We see things sometimes that are not there, and sometimes we don't see things that are there. And most of the authorities that we accept, whether they're parental authorities, government authorities, really make mistakes. Sometimes they cheat, and they're illusioned. So we're sort of caught in a dilemma that we really can't know something for sure, like I've asked all of you, besides the Krishna conscious paradigm. What do you know for sure? I mean, it's very hard to figure out what you know for sure. You could say, you know, for sure, I'm sitting here in this room, right? How do you know that for sure? It could be a dream. And then someone could shake you and wake up. I mean, I have so many dreams, and I dream that I'm somewhere, and then I wake up and I'm not there. Has anyone ever dreamt at night? Yeah. So how do you know this is a dream? Or how do you know you're not plugged into some supercomputer somewhere like the Matrix? And you haven't taken the right pill, you know, to get out of the illusion. How do you know that for sure? Can you say that for sure? No. So really, what can you say for sure? I mean, we don't want to bring you to the point, like in that Beatles song, nothing is real, strawberry fields forever. But really, if you think about it, you know, your senses of perception are imperfect, including the mind. You know, the six senses, including the mind. They deceive you in many cases. So you really can't say for sure what's real and what's not real unless you have a connection with some person who is, let's say, speaking from the absolute platform or with perfect senses or whatever. And that person, of course, is G-O-D, God. Because the only perfect person I know in the sense that someone who knows everything, omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent, all these big O things, you know, omnipresent, omnipotent, omniscient, all good, all the all stuff, you know, that's God. So The Vedic literatures teach us what? Dharmam tu satcha bhagavat pranitam. The only way you can understand dharma, dharma means really the inherent quality of the thing, what the reality of the thing. The only way you can understand something in reality is to have some absolute, perfect person who's given you that knowledge. Okay, so that's what we call epistemology, the study of knowledge. How do you know what you know? So, you have God, but most of us don't have his email address. God@gmail.com. You can try it. I don't think it'll work. You get someone else. You get some imposter. And actually, there's many people who come who say they're God. Especially from India, I remember in the 1960s. Prabhupada would say that every week another God is coming from India. Because we had all these gods. I mean, there was one god who was 16 or 17 years old, a boy. And he came from India, he established a very big society around himself. I'm not going to say what his name was. But then God had some spiritual trouble. He fell down with his secretaries. God ran away with his secretary. So, then his mother, went to court in India and declared, that son is not God, but my other son is God. It took out a whole court case, you know, to determine which son was God. It's nice having a son who's God, isn't it? You don't ever have to work. So, and there were other gods. Some gods came from India with big furry hair on their heads. Other gods, you know, just said that they had big long beards, and they said, I'm God, you're God, we're all God. And so, you know, which God is the real God? So, first of all, we have to determine which God is the real God, and then who can represent him. So the real God has several different qualities. First of all, he's called Bhagawan because he has all the attractive qualities, like he's all beautiful, he's all intelligent. He's all famous. He's all strong. And these are some of the qualities of God. Now you look at all these other incarnations who came from India, for example, or even, there was even one who came from Korea. I'm not going to mention his name. They were not beautiful or attractive or handsome. They were kind of ugly. So there's first strike, they're out. They lost it on the first vote, you know. So you don't even have to examine whether they're all intelligent or all strong or whatever. They're just not God. It's obvious. So, but then you take a look at Krishna and you say, well, he has all these different qualities. So that's the first point. And then another point is mentioned in the Gita, Hustvam Rishiyav Sarve Deva Shir Naradastata. Where Arjuna is saying that I can understand your God because all the great sages have also said that you're God. You know, great personalities. So, there's different evidence like that. And so, let's say you do your whole examination, come to the conclusion that Krishna is God. So, alright, so, because we don't have direct contact with Krishna right now, at least we can't perceive that direct contact. How do we understand what he wants from us? You know, he's saying in the Gita, Krishna says in the Gita, Sarva Dhammam Pratyaja Mam Ekam Sharanam Vraja, which is a real generic, general statement, which means surrender unto me, don't worry. Okay, well, what does that mean, surrender to Krishna? So therefore you need someone who represents him to be able to ascertain what Krishna wants you to do. And that person is called Guru. How do you understand who actually represents Krishna? There's several different objective standards. One objective standard is the cyclic succession, as Krishna himself states in the fourth chapter of the Gita. Evam parampara praptam imam rajashaya virhu. In other words, he must come down in an unbroken chain of the spiritual masters from Krishna himself. And there's four basic disciplic successions. They come down from Krishna. The first one is the one we're in, which is called the Brahma disciplic succession. And then there's the Rudra disciplic succession, Kumara disciplic succession. And surprisingly, one of the disciplic successions is headed up by a lady. So Krishna was not a chauvinist. Now there's some discussion in ISKCON, you know, can ladies be gurus? Isn't it? Heard about that discussion? But actually, one of the main charyas and one of the main disciplic successions is a lady. Her name is Lakshmi. She means wealth, too. So, anyway, you have these four disciplic successions, and they've been extant, in other words, they're present, passing down spiritual knowledge since time immemorial. And so if someone is a bona fide member of a disciplic succession, follows strictly, doesn't invent anything, serves his preceptor, guru, then that person can give spiritual knowledge. That person can be accepted as a guru. Then there's different types of gurus too. And it's not only the guru you take initiation from, that's called Diksha Guru, the Shiksha Guru, Vartma Pradarshika Guru. Means anybody who gives you some guidance can be considered a guru. Even someone who gives you some guidance in material things, that's a material guru. Like someone who teaches you how to play the violin, for example, that's guru. Or teaches you how to fight. He's my martial arts guru. You can say that too. But here we're talking about spiritual gurus. So it's necessary to hear from someone who is connected with Krishna. And what does that guru do? I mean, what is his function? Like, most people take the guru as like a rock and roll star. You know, like people took the Beatles in the 1960s. You know, heard about the Beatles before? No. Anyway, the Beatles were doing their concert, whatever, and people were screaming, oh, what, Ringo? Oh, George? Isn't it? Oh, Ringo, Ringo. Like that. Because he's a drummer. So, most people take a guru like that as something like a rock and roll, fancy version, a spiritual version of a rock and roll star. But actually, the guru's function is to engage his shisha, that means student, according to the shisha's psychophysical nature. That comes out, that's very interesting. Because it's not just philosophy he gives. Yeah, he gives the philosophy. What is the philosophy basically? You're not the body, you're undergoing reincarnation. You're part and parcel of Krishna. The purpose of everything is to get out of the material world, go back to Godhead, chant Hare Krishna, and you'll be happy. Eat prasadam and you'll be free. Not too much prasadam. Because eat too much, you'll be entangled. Eat too little, you get sick. And eat the right amount of prasadam, you go back to Godhead. Prabhupada said many people have fallen down in the name of Mahaprasadam. That means they've eaten too much. Like Acharya, you know, eating too much. So, yes, that's the basic philosophy. You know, we're the soul within the body, and we're undergoing reincarnation, and karma is there, and the material world is created by Krishna. You know, the five truths mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita, the tattvas. And so, but beyond that, we need a personal relationship with a guide, as a spirit guide. It's a new word that people use nowadays. A spirit guide. Nowadays, when people say spirit guide, that means someone who doesn't have a body, right? You ever heard that term before? So, I have a spirit guide. He comes to me in the middle of the night. Or I have another one is angels. That people really get into angels nowadays. You heard about that? Oh, I'm protected by angels. With wings. Maybe they've been smoking too much. But, you know, you started to see angels. I have the name of some psychiatrist you can see. So, anyways, a spirit guide means a spiritual guide, but who practically tells you how to work in this world. Two things he tells you how to do. One is called the sadhana. Sadhana means your practice, because you got to practice being a devotee in the beginning. Because our natural inclination, due to habit, is to not be devotees. You know, we have habits. Addictions, habits. And so naturally, you know, we don't want to, for example, we don't want to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I remember that was one of the first hardest things I ever encountered in the Krishna consciousness movement. Before I joined the movement, this was 1969, before any of you were born. I came to the temple and they said, basically, they told me I was going to hell if I didn't become a devotee. Yeah, they literally said that. You're going to, they said, Kali Yuga is coming, you're going to be assured and living underground and eating human flesh. It hasn't happened yet. So, and they said, your next life will be a dog. I said, you know, and they said, you better join right now and get rid of that hair. There's a lot of hair, you know, like that. And they get rid of the hair. Get rid of the hair, and guess what? I said, where's the door? And where's the way out of the temple? That was in 1969. So it took 2 more years until I met Prabhupada, until I actually, you know, cut my hair off. So that was the hardest part. So anyway, so the hair and the waking up early and the wearing the bed sheets, you know, the dhotis. Because in those days, in the early days of the movement, we didn't have dhotis, real dhotis, or kurtas. We just went to the store where you sold bed sheets, you know what bed sheet is, and wrapped the bed sheets around ourselves. And that was our dhotis. And we used regular Western shirts. For sure. I mean, we were happy too. It didn't hurt us. So basically, the guru, his business is to give certain austerities. And austerity means things that are good for your spiritual life that you ordinarily wouldn't want to do due to your past conditioning. Like waking up early. I mean, I was accustomed to waking up at like 10 o'clock in the morning. That was normal. I'm sure people here do the same thing. Not you all, but people in Copenhagen, right? You know, nightlife. The night is still young at 2 o'clock in the morning. Don't people ever say that? The night is still young. You know, it's time for fun, you know. So because Prabhupada gave those instructions, so I didn't accept that until I met Prabhupada. Because these devotees, actually all the devotees I had met before were very new devotees. They were just in the movement 1 or 2 years. I mean, that was the way the movement was. If you were in the movement 3 years, you were a senior devotee, ready to take sannyas. We had devotees 3 or 4 years in the movement take sannyas. It was pretty wild. When you had 22-year-old devotees taking sannyas who were just in the movement 3 years, and they thought they'd become God by taking sannyas, because they could eat all the mahaprasadam. So when you're 22 years old, you definitely think about eating mahaprasadam a lot. So that's like a brahmachari's dream come true, a young brahmachari's dream come true. So what happened? I took sannyas at 28, which was kind of early too. So what happened is that I really didn't want to surrender, change anything, until I met my guru. And the reason I accepted Prabhupada was that Prabhupada was a pure devotee. But, you know, you may say, how did I know that? Because you could see in Prabhupada's countenance he was 100% dedicated to pleasing Krishna. And he had no false ego. In other words, he didn't preach to me heavy that I was going to hell. Prabhupada was just extremely loving and compassionate and wanted the best. He was the first person I met in my life that wanted the best for me without any personal motive. First person. And, you know, I'm talking about my mother. My mother is very nice too. You know, not, but she wanted something for me. She wanted me to be a doctor. Why did she want me to be a doctor? For her prestige. You know, she preached to me continually when I was in the university, you gotta be a doctor, you gotta be a doctor. And then when I joined the movement, she said, I'm dying because you're not a doctor. But 40 years later, she's still alive. So she hasn't died. So, I mean, it shows. So, my mother loves me, but she had some personal motive there. You know, she wanted something from me. But Prabhupada didn't want anything. He just wanted to give me the best, which was Krishna consciousness, without any false ego, personal motive. And Prabhupada was fully realized as a spiritual personality. First time I met Prabhupada, it was like the whole room expanded to eternity. It was in 1971 in a place called Gainesville, Florida. The whole room just, I was like I entered the spiritual world. I felt like I didn't have a body anymore. Just by being in Prabhupada's physical presence. And, you know, so many amazing stories, like, and I got to be with Prabhupada in his room in the middle of the night. He was just dressed in a gumsha, and Prabhupada had golden skin, like Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And he was just, I mean, Prabhupada's stature, that means height, physical height was not that much. But his spiritual stature was unlimited. And so just being in the same room with Prabhupada, you know, just like, wow, I'm back to God. I already thought I was a pure devotee. Just by being with Prabhupada. Of course, when I walked out of the room, I understood I wasn't a pure devotee. It's called the newbie experience. You know, the new person experiences like that. So, so then I accepted Prabhupada. And then under Prabhupada's direction, talking about the spiritual master's function, I did all the things that I didn't want to do. I was already a vegetarian, so that wasn't a problem. But I started, the first day I chanted 16 rounds, woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and the hair was gone. Like that. I mean, it took a little while, cut it off. But, so that's the function of the spiritual master. And Prabhupada was imposing, or not imposing, Prabhupada was guiding us in this way for our own good. Why? Every religion, every instruction of Prabhupada has a purpose. What was the purpose? To cultivate the mode of goodness. That's why you get up early. Because if you get up at 10 o'clock in the morning, it's hard to be in the mode of goodness. It's pretty ignorant, isn't it? So, and then chanting rounds early in the morning, Mangalarti, there's a whole sadhana. That's called sadhana. Sadhana bhakti means bhakti in practice. And the first part of bhakti in practice is called vaidhi, which means you follow rules and regulations. After a while, it becomes spontaneous. It really does. After a while, you do things automatically. I mean, in the beginning, yes, I had to force myself. You get up early because Prabhupada wants it. And so I had to have like 2 alarm clocks. You know how people have these alarm clocks, they push the snooze button on it, and it goes off 10 minutes later, and then you keep pushing the same button again and again, and it's 4 hours later before they actually get up. So I had to put the alarm clock like at least 10 meters away from me, because it was right next to me, you turn it off. So you had to get off, up and turn it. I remember one devotee had an alarm clock that talked. It said, "Wake up! Wake up! Wake up!" You know, like the trumpet. Called Reveille. Wake up in the morning. So anyway, so in the beginning it was some difficulty forcing oneself. Just like Prabhupada gave the example that when one has jaundice, which is a disease of the liver, sugar doesn't taste good. But when you take more sugar, it actually cures the jaundice, particular type of jaundice, not all jaundice. And so in the beginning it was hard. Or like Krishna says in the Gita, happiness in the mode of goodness, in the beginning is like poison, at the end it's like nectar, right? That's what the Gita tells us. So that's the austerity. So I followed Prabhupada's instruction with faith, and then it's spontaneous. I mean, I get up in the morning, I don't need an alarm clock anymore. Automatically, it's just like 2:30 or 3, even earlier now. Because you get a taste. Ruchi, you understand? You get a taste for doing it. Because you become cured of some of the material, let's say, impediments to Krishna consciousness. And you get it, and you start to like it after a while. Material things work like that too. Like certain things in the material world, you don't like in the beginning, and then after a while you like. I'll give you an example. I had one devotee join the movement, and she was an alcoholic before she joined. That means she liked to drink alcohol. So I asked her, I said, "How can you tolerate the taste of that?" I mean, only one time in my life took a drop of wine or something like that at a religious ceremony. Not Hare Krishna religious. Don't worry. You know, there's a religion I was brought up in, there was wine sometimes. And it tasted like fire in the mouth. It really did. It tasted like I take like some chilies, put it in the mouth, liquid chilies. And so I said to her, how could you tolerate it? And she said, "Well, in the beginning it was hard, but you began to do it enough. And it's like nectar." She said that. And I couldn't understand it, but Krishnamagita says, Karnam Guna Sangasya Sadasa Janma Jonishu, when you actually associate with certain modes of nature, you actually become, let's say, contaminated or indoctrinated or under the power of those modes, you begin to like that. Like you could like almost anything if you do it enough. Like in Korea, they eat this thing called liquid dog. You ever heard of that before? That means they take all the dead animals and they throw them into a big vat and let them ferment for a year. And then they take the liquid and they put it in a bottle and it's delicious. In other words, they consider it a delicacy. So, because you do it, or smoking, for example. I mean, the first time people smoke, they don't think it's nice, do they? They just go. But their friends keep saying, oh, keep doing it. Yeah, it's nice. So, out of social pressure, they keep doing it. And guess what? They start to get addicted. It's not that they really like it, they're addicted to it. It's an addiction. So whenever you contemplate, Krishna in the Gita, the second chapter of the Gita talks about this, when you contemplate sense objects, jayato vishakvamsam, then you get attached to them. And then you get, lusty and angry and all those other things. So spiritually it works in a similar fashion. When you do some spiritual activity, because you really get pleasure from it. It's not like painful. You get pleasure, and it's not like a material addiction. So the more you do it, then you get a taste for it, and the taste grows. Like the material taste for anything material, it has a beginning and an end. I mean, it's just, you get tired of something. I mean, if you eat the same thing every day, you get tired of it. But spiritually, we can chant the whole day and night, and we never get tired. I mean, my favorite activity is on Ekadashi. Because on Ekadashi, I generally try to chant 64 rounds a day. Whenever I'm not involved in other services. And I just look forward to it. Because that's a day I can just say, forget about email a little bit. Forget about the mobile phone for a while. And then just chant and just get absorbed. And my favorite place to be is Govardhan. Where I can just wake up in the morning, walk out the door after I do my deity worship, because I do that every day. And then just chant, continually chant for hours and hours and hours, because it gets more and more pleasurable. That's the point. So that's the benefit of following the spiritual master's instruction, of finding a proper spiritual master. So that's one aspect. I said that there were two aspects. The first aspect is that sadhana, the practice. The second aspect is basically doing something in this world that is in accordance with your psychophysical nature. Now, I'll unpack that statement. That means we all have a certain varna. That means every one of us is either Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Shudra by varna. I mean, you can chant your whole life, but you're going to still have a varna, a psychophysical varna. Look at Arjuna, for example. He was the best devotee, one of the best devotees, and he was a Kshatriya. And Krishna said, if you don't follow your varna, you're going to be forced to do it anyway. You're going to fight. In other words, he was Kshatriya. Kshatriya doesn't mean just fight. Many people who like to fight are not Kshatriyas, they're just Shudras. It's not that you go to a wrestling match and say, oh, there's two Kshatriyas there. Or you go to a soccer match and say, oh, the Kshatriyas are doing soccer today. They're not Kshatriyas. They're Shudras. Because a Kshatriya is one who likes to protect others. That's a really important point. So the varma is part of the body. You can't get away from it. I mean, you like to do certain things. Of course, you can do them for Krishna. Like if someone is an artist, that's considered Shudra varna, but that's not bad, that's good. Every varna is good. Because anyone, as Krishna says in the Gita, doing his duty, can go back to Krishna, go back to Godhead. Achieve perfection. It's not that one is better than the other. No one should think like that. So, you got the Shudra, you got the Vaishya. Vaishya means, Krishigo Raksha Vanijam, Vaishya Karma Svabhavajam, means cow protection and commerce, trade and stuff like that. and Kshatriya I already described, and then you got the Brahmin who's the head of society. And you really shouldn't try to imitate someone else's varna in your daily activities for several reasons. One reason is you won't be able to be absorbed in it. You won't be happy. You really won't be happy. You may know how to do it, but you won't be happy. I mean, for example, I know how to do construction. I was an engineer. But if you ask me to do it all day long, I'll just go crazy. It's just like, you know, I'd rather go hang gliding or something. It's something interesting. So, you know, it's just boring for me. What was that example? I was thinking about it. So, I was thinking of Karna. Karna, of course, was a Kshatriya. He's a character in the Mahabharata. And Karna tried to act like a Brahmin one time. How did he try to act like a Brahmin? Well, he approached this guru named Parashuram. You've all heard of Parashuram before? Parashuram is the warrior incarnation of God. He's the one who hated Kshatriyas. The reason he hated Kshatriyas is because one of them killed his father. And he chopped off the heads of all the Kshatriyas and killed 21 generations of Kshatriyas. So he had, let's say, post-traumatic stress, PTSD, you know. He really hated Kshatriyas like anything. So if he wanted to become, in this particular case, Karna wanted to become Parashuram's disciple, but he didn't want to tell him he was a Kshatriya, right? So he went to Parashuram, please, Gurudev, let me become your disciple. Because why? Parashuram had knowledge of all the weapons. So there was Karna with Parashuram. So one time, Parashuram he was resting a little bit, and Karna was acting as the pillow. In other words, Parashuram's head was on Karna's lap. You've heard about this story before. Some of you have heard this story before. Very interesting story. So then this big bug, you know, like about this big, starts to burrow his way into Karna's leg. You know, if you ask, you know, just to talk about it makes me an anxiety. But Kshatriyas have a specific quality. They can tolerate pain. Whereas Brahmanas, they can't. You know, if you do stick a pin in a Brahmin, he'll scream. But if you stick 1,000 arrows in a Kshatriya, he'll go on fighting. You have the story of Grandfather Bhishma, who was fighting against Arjuna, of course, and Arjuna was firing the arrows. Grandfather Bhishma was not able to fire back, because Shikhandi was used as a human shield. And Grandfather Bhishma was still rushing at Arjuna, in spite of being filled with arrows. There were so many arrows in his body, it's described that there was hardly a finger's breadth distance between the arrows. That's a Kshatriya. That's a real Kshatriya. Can any of you do that? I don't think so. Kshatriya is the only one who could do that. You know, heroes, that's real heroic, isn't it? If you're filled with arrows, or you have one arrow, and you know, if one arrow hit me, I'd be screaming. And not only that, sometimes when they were hit by an arrow, they could pull it out of their bodies like that and go on fighting. Could you imagine? Like that. So here was Karna, who was a Kshatriya by nature, and Parashuram, who hated Kshatriyas. So this big insect or bug or worm was crawling its way through Karna's leg. And there was some blood, and one of the drops of blood fell on Parashuram. And Parashuram came back to consciousness and said, "Whoa, what's this?" And Karna explained, "It was blood." And Parashuram said, "How did it get there?" Karna explained, "There was this bug here." And Parashuram said, "Why did you jump up?" And Karna said, "I didn't want to disturb you, Gurudev." And then as soon as he said that, Parashuram understood that he wasn't a Brahmin, that he was a Kshatriya, and Parashuram cursed him. He cursed him, "You're going to forget your Brahmastra mantra, all your mantras, when it comes time for your death." And that's exactly what happened. When Arjuna got ready to kill Karna, Karna forgot his mantra. He just couldn't say, what was that, Hare Krishna, 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 no. Krishna, Krishna. It was like he couldn't forget a mantra that he was very familiar with before. So there's an example of someone trying to be in a different varna than he actually was in. I mean, if you put a Brahmin... Actually, Prabhupada also gave the example during the Vietnam War of Shudras who were inducted into the army and they were fighting. You know, in the Vietnam War, the Americans were fighting in Vietnam against the so-called communists. And he said that because they were Shudras, then they just started smoking marijuana during the battle. It's true. And sometimes they just shot their own officers during the battle. They were intoxicated. Can you imagine being in the battlefield where the army is firing at you and rushing at you and you're smoking marijuana? I mean, this is really, because they were Shudras. Whereas a Kshatriya would just rush up there and, you know, fighting, heroic, not experiencing pain. So in other words, getting back to the guru question, the guru engages the disciple according to their nature in some practical activity. Like in the temple, it would be deity worship, for example. But let's say someone's a businessman. You know, someone by nature is Vaishya, their business. You wouldn't want them doing deity worship all the time. They can do it once a week. But if they go on the altar, they're just going to be making deals with Krishna. That happens in India. People go to the deities. Those of you from India know what I'm talking about. You go to Balaji, for example. That's in Tirumala, South India. And people make a deal, you know, I have this business going on, Krishna, and I will give you 50%. Isn't it? Or 20%, whatever, you know, they give Krishna, make Krishna a partner in business. I'll give you a certain percentage if it's successful. And they come back and they pay. And Balaji is the richest deity in the world. The hundi, that's the donation box, is so big that sometimes people drop their children in it by accident. It's true. Actually, by accident, there's some stories about that. One time someone dropped their little boy in it by accident and the devotees, you know, in the temple said, no, he has to become a pujari now. He has to work with us. You lost him. So, it actually happened like that. Because whatever you give to Krishna, you can't take back. So, just be careful around the donation box. So, fortunately, there's a little light slot in the box there, so you can't lose too much. No refunds. So it's a common thing. That's why the donation box is, and they have to keep changing the donation box every hour or something like that, because it fills up. And also, there's another reason too. They're helping Krishna pay off a debt, but that's a different story. I don't have time to tell right now. But, so if you're a Vaishya, then you'd just be doing business with Krishna. Isn't it? I mean, so you shouldn't be full-time pujari if you're a Vaishya. And if you're a Shudra, I don't know, shouldn't be on the altar that much. If you're a Shudra, you should be doing something with your hands. You know, basically artwork, music. I mean, it's all nice things. No one is less than anyone else. They just have, they're different. Remember that. Varnashram doesn't mean less or better or higher. It just means different. If we remember that, then we'll be happy to engage in some things according to our nature. And then we'll be more stable in Krishna consciousness. So the guru does that, helps the disciple understand what their nature is. He doesn't micromanage the life of the disciple. He's not the matchmaker saying, get married to this girl. I tried it, it doesn't work. When you do it and it doesn't work out, they blame you. So, but the guru gives general instructions or facilitates the student as to what his duty is in this world. You know, if you're a Brahmin, fine. But as a Brahmin, you have to be ready to live very simply. No Mercedes for you. Yeah, isn't it? I mean, what if you see this sannyasi driving around in a BMW? I mean, what do you think about that? Or a sannyasi with jewelry all over his body, you know, like earrings and everything. It was an interesting story about Lord Nityananda. Lord Nityananda, of course, is Lord Nityananda. He also had jewelry and everything, even when he was sannyasi. So people should follow their prescribed duty for Krishna in accordance with their psychophysical nature under the guidance of spiritual master. They mean Shikshaguru, like this. And this is, and how do you understand what your psychophysical nature is? The final thing, I don't take questions. You can understand by thinking about what you could do 10 hours a day without going crazy. Think about it. Some activity you can do for 10 hours and you won't lose your mind. You know, because you can do a lot of things, because we're all mixed castes here in Kali Yuga. There's a lot of things. I mean, I know how to do a lot of things. I can do music, I can do construction, I can read books, I can preach, it's my education, I'm an engineer by education. I wouldn't be a good fighter. No, that I wouldn't be good. But what would I like to do all day long? To really keep my mind absorbed. And for me that means philosophy, study, learning things, and teaching. So that's more of a rabbinical thing. Even though I can do everything, a lot of other things, so that's easy, it's easy to ascertain your nature that way. And just one final story, then we'll take questions. With the Pandavas, when they won Draupadi, they were acting or dressed as Brahmins. So Drupada didn't know what Varna they were. So what he did is he put out the implements for each Varna. He put out, let's say, swords and everything for the Kshatriyas, books for the Brahmins, and the hammer and shovel for the Shudras, and gold for the Vaishyas. And when the Pandavas walked in, guess what way they went? Immediately to the swords. They picked it up. Wow, look at that. That's cool. Look at that sharp sword. Isn't that nice? Whew. Yeah, so you can do that with devotees too. In fact, with children, they have this ceremony. Maybe when you pick someone's propensity when they first crawl. Anyone seen this ceremony? In India, have this ceremony. Where you put out the money, the books, a hammer, and a sword. And now they should put out a rifle or a gun. And the child crawls and it immediately goes, poof, grabs something. Either the gold, the money, the golden money, or the book, or something like that. And that's tradition done in India, that they choose at a particular point like that. But even we can tell what we're attracted to. Books, money. Well, you have gold here. You can just see who looks at it. Because we don't have any gold. No, I have no gold on me at all. Very unfortunate, sannyasi. So, no gold. So, it says wave gold. And then you can just see. So, yeah, you had a question?
You answered the question, something of it, but it was the question how you deal with the Varna Sankara, because as we know about the Gita, as pointed out, that the population
of Kali Yuga is Varna
Sankara. It's mixed Varna.
That Prabhupada did say that we're mixed castes of unknown origin. But we always have a predominance. We do have.
If somebody, you ask the question, just actually we can do 10 hours a day, you know, without going crazy. But if somebody, I really don't know what that is.
That means it's a Shudra. It means he has to be made to work. Yeah. It basically usually means that's a Shudra. If someone cannot think of something they really like to do, they're in the mode of ignorance. If someone says, well, I'd like to sleep for 10 hours a day. You know, I can think of a lot of things I'd like to do for 10 hours a day. You know, I'd like to, you know, study, take notes, things like that. I mean, you get tired. It's not that I could do it for 10 hours a day because my eyes get tired and the body gets tired, but psychologically I could do it. That's what I'm talking about. Physically, there's limitations, especially as you get older, what you can do. But psychologically, it enthuses me. If I can learn new things, I like learning about things. About Krishna consciousness, and I also like right now I'm studying about how to improve the health of devotees. So this is, you know, I'd love to study things, practical things in this world, Because a Brahman doesn't mean just Krishna consciousness. A Brahman is expert in many spheres. He can teach anything. He may not do it, but he teaches. Like the Brahman, he would teach martial arts in the Gurukul. But he wouldn't do it. He wouldn't fight. Generally, it was an emergency. He wouldn't fight, but he would teach. So a Brahman can teach any of the arts. A Brahman can teach how to dance. A Brahman can teach how to, you know, business or something like that. As Prabhupada said. He said, Prabhupada said about Varnashram College, we don't need to teach business because it's just cheating. We don't need to teach people how to cheat. In other words, buying things at a low price, selling it at a high price. But Brahman can teach anything. But it's not his prime focus in life. So if we cannot find something we'd like to do for so many hours a day, I mean, it's not a good sign. Yeah.
According to Vedic astrology, it's pretty easy to determine the Brahman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you have an expert astrologer. If you really have an expert astrologer, there was one book that was just published in ISKCON, How to Ruin Your Life with Astrology. Has anyone read that book? Yeah, it's a very nice book. I really like it. Because you have these people who pose, first of all, they pose as astrologers. Really, they don't know what they're doing. Because to study astrology or be a good astrologer, you have to really be immersed in it for many, many years. And secondly, they give people what's called self-fulfilling prophecies. That means they say to someone who's... The typical example in the book she gives, she says that there would be people who would say to a married couple, I can see this is not going to work. That you're going to find a new girlfriend. And so that's a self-fulfilling prophecy because he's thinking it's not going to work. And you can put a lot of ideas in people's minds from a position of authority. You know, whether you're an astrologer or a bogus guru or whatever, you can implant things in people's minds that will bewilder them. So, I'd be careful. I mean, if your astrology says you're a particular nature and it's done by an expert astrologer, that's one thing. But you really have to see what you'd like to do, too. Like if my astrologer says, well, you should be a Kshatriya, and I don't feel like that, then something's wrong. You know, if I can't get into being a Kshatriya or a manager, Kshatriyas generally, and Vaishyas are managers. Let me give you a practical example of my own life. Like as a GBC, oftentimes we're called to do management. And it's not something I really like to do, but I do it because it's a service to Prabhupada. So if someone said that you should do this 12 hours a day, I'm not going to do it. Because the Prabhupada said it, I'll do anything. That's another thing. But Prabhupada's not saying it. Krishna doesn't say to Arjuna, you become a Brahmin, because it's not possible. So you really have to do some internal soul searching to determine your varna. Astrology is helpful, yes, if you have a good astrologer. But it has to come really from you. I mean, if you're forced to do something you don't want to do, your real nature will come out eventually. Or you'll get depressed or frustrated. Yeah.
This morning we read a section of Bhagavad Gita, where Prabhupada in purpose, he says that you have to be very careful to choose an Udmanikara.
Yes.
As your spiritual master. So, Prabhupada is an Utmanikara, Bhaktisiddhanta is an Utmanikara.
Yeah.
Could you give a definition of...
Yes, I mean, all of us, it's very interesting, all of us in ISKCON are choosing Prabhupada as our ultimate source of information, Shiksha. Shiksha connection is more important than Diksha connection. We may be initiated, I mean... Our initiating guru may be an Uttamanikara. I'm not saying that nobody is. We may not. I'm not passing judgment on anybody. However, Siksha is most important. And so we all take shelter of Prabhupada. We've all accepted Prabhupada as our guru. But if we just accept Prabhupada and don't take guidance from anyone else, even if we're initiated by Prabhupada, we need the Vaishnava Sangha to take guidance from other devotees. I mean, I have many godbrothers I go to. I ask you, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And we take guidance from each other. Like Prabhupada said, we're like many sticks. If one stick is by itself, it can be broken. If you keep them all together, you can't break them. So we all need to accept at least Shiksha Gurus from even our peers, you know, people who are our friends like that, or from others. But Prabhupada is our ultimate source of Shiksha, so I think everybody who's a bona fide member of ISKCON should be accepting Prabhupada as the primary Shiksha. And that's, of course, GBC rule, too. But so in this way, we're all safe. And then let's say, I really want to take Diksha from an Uttamadhikari too. Yeah, you may be thinking like that. All right. So then you have to come up with an Uttamadhikari test. That's kind of hard. I mean, you can see externally up to the level of Nishtha. That you can see. Nishtha means steady, 24 hours a day. But what is your Uttamadhikari test? And with Prabhupada, it's very easy. You know, he spread Krishna consciousness all over the world. He changed, got every town and village chanting Hare Krishna. Nobody could do that except for Uttamadhikari. Yeah, that's good. But for the rest of everybody else, what would you do? Stick a pin in someone, see if they feel pain? Or you ask someone, you know, have you been dancing with Krishna last night? I mean, it's hard for me. I mean, sometimes people outside of ISKCON say, therefore you have to accept Uttamadhikari, so take initiation outside of ISKCON. That's a political thing. You know, but how do you know? How do you know there is Uttamadhikari? And plus, if you're accepting Prabhupada actually said, to stay, your love will be tested, famous quote, by staying within his institution in Prabhupada's society and cooperating. So that's Prabhupada's instruction to us. And we're all meant to be sishas, that means students of his divine relationship with Prabhupada. And we're safe that way. We're safe because initiation is not as important as siksha or instruction. And you find... Let's go to the Ramanuja Sampradaya, for example. Sripad Ramanujacharya is the Acharya. But there are so many gurus now who initiate you, but they all focus, everyone focuses on Ramanujacharya. Yeah. And one of the reasons, I'm getting into a little ISKCON history, one of the reasons this has been a little confusing was because of the dynamic that naturally occurs when a charismatic person leaves this world. In this study of sociology of religion, there's something called the charismatic phase and the post-charismatic phase, if you've ever studied sociology of religion. In the charismatic phase, you have a leader like Prabhupada, or like Jesus Christ, or like any of these founders of the religions, like Ramanujacharya, Madhvacharya, who start a whole society based on their not mundane charisma, spiritual charisma. But then, what happens is when they leave, there's two things that can happen. One is, you get people trying to imitate them. The next group of leaders tries to imitate them and become acharyas on their own. That's what happened with the Gaudiya Math. And they split up into many different Gaudiya Maths. And many of them are great devotees. It's not meant as a criticism of anyone. But they split up. Because basically they thought the only way to spread Krishna consciousness was to be like Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur and be your own acharya. Whereas that was not Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur's instruction. His instruction was to manage together, not to have an acharya, have gurus but no acharyas. So ISKCON to a certain extent went through that phase too, where you had the initial gurus in ISKCON who pretty much assumed positions of acharyas with a big A. And that caused a lot of division and confusion in the society. That was the initial stage. That, of course, that happens practically in every religious institution. There's the post-charismatic phase, and then the next phase is called the institutionalization of charisma phase. I'm speaking about sociology now. Because ISKCON is a classic case of the sociology of religion. It's not different. I mean, there's certain dynamics that occur in this world that in sociology, they're just there. You know, group dynamics. So, what happened is that in this next stage, which we're going through right now, is the charisma or the attraction is invested in the original founder and his society. And that's really where we're going to now in ISKCON. Whereas the emphasis on the Diksha Guru will not be, and it is diminishing right now, on, you know, the fanaticism that, you know, my Diksha Guru is better than your Diksha Guru. In Gaudiya Math, they even had fights about it. In front of the deities, you know, one disciple was chanting another Diksha Guru's pranam mantra, and they started punching each other. No, mine is my guru. No, my guru. Like little kids, you know. You know, my father. No, my father's stronger than your father. So it's rather immature. The charismatic phase is also characterized by immaturity. Like when Prabhupada was on the planet, I mean, Prabhupada's a pure devotee, but there's so much immaturity in the movement. I mean, people think we have problems now, but when Prabhupada was on the planet, Prabhupada was having to break up fights between devotees all the time. And, you know, one devotee started a temple, the temple grew, and then he sold the temple and ran away with the money. I mean, I can tell you so many stories of things that occur. You know, you had Tamal Krishnamurti, a great devotee. He was stealing devotees from temples. Had to get sent to China by Prabhupada. You know, all sorts of interesting things happened in our society. And there was a lot of immaturity. Now there's much more maturity. So there's different stages of growth. And we're going through the normal stage of growth right now, which is a healthy stage if we want to be here 1,000 years from now. And that's the institutionalization of charisma, where, you know, we see Prabhupada and Prabhupada's society, we remain faithful to the society, and the Diksha Guru is seen as a function of the society. That's an interesting dynamic. In the same way, yeah, as a function of the society, as a person who works for the society, rather than an independently self-effulgent, you know, 1,000 watts, 1,000 lumens. You know what a lumen is? A lumen is a measure of brightness. So like, oh, my guru is as bright as the sun. My guru is bright as 10,000 suns. So he's seen as a cooperative member of a cooperative society. And this is healthy. It's healthy. And then we all work together. It doesn't matter who your initiating guru is as far as working. You know, to me it doesn't matter. Like even for myself, you know, I have some disciples, but I don't even notice the difference between the people who are my disciples and people who are other people's disciples. I treat everybody the same. It's not, even sometimes, people say, you know, I'm in a certain place where I have disciples, and they say, you should have a disciple meeting. I say, I'm not going to have a disciple meeting. I'll meet with all the devotees. Because, you know, we're all part of the same team. This factionalism is really something we don't want. You know, we can take inspiration from different people, but we don't want it to cause factions in the society. So we have Prabhupada Uttamadhikari. Other people, maybe. I mean, I'm not, like I said, I don't want to judge anyone. Any other questions? Yeah,
Benedetti. What are the qualifications for a disciple?
Qualifications for a disciple? That a disciple should, Brahmachari Gurukule Vasandandagaro Hita Marchyang Dasabandicho. A disciple should make, I'm just going by what Prahlad Maharaj said, make his home an ashram, whether he's living, he or she is living in the temple or outside the temple, to make the home a place of Krishna. It's called Gurukula, place of the Guru. Not only, Gurukula doesn't mean school, it means a place to guru. Brahmachari Gurukule, Muslim, not the Gurohitam. And learn that whatever one does should be for the benefit, Gurohitam, of the guru. That I'm working, of course the guru is transparently representing Krishna and in the cyclic succession. Like someone at, yeah, here's an interesting story that recently occurred to me. Someone wrote to me, this happens all the time actually, someone wrote to me and said, well, I just discovered I'm a gopi in the spiritual world. And, you know, they actually told me, you know, which group gopis they were in and everything like that. I said, oh, that's, I said, no, that's very nice. I said, I just discovered I'm a servant to Prabhupada. And they said, well, what about your spiritual body? And they said, well, I like to hang around with Narada Muni too. And preach and serve Prabhupada life after life. So really, yes, of course, one does begin to understand after some time, hopefully, what they are in the spiritual world, but the predominant concentration is rendering service. Like Prabhupada said, deserve, then desire. So we render service to the guru. The guru is representing Krishna. And I just like to identify myself as a servant. Gopi Bharata Kamala Pada Kamala Dasa 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 Anadasa, right? So that's, you're safe when you do that. So that's Gaurahitam and Archian. He has learned good behavior. Good behavior means when Prabhupada said, he was asked, what is the quality of your disciple? Prabhupada said, he or she is a perfect gentleman or lady. In other words, not only good behavior with sadhana, but whoever meets us should think, here's the perfect gentleman, you know. Here's someone I really like. You know, there's so many stories about Prabhupada I can tell where people met Prabhupada, and then even 20 years later, they said, where's that person I met? They didn't even know who he was. He was so nice. There's so many stories about that. He was so nice. Wow, where is he now? And even they're not devotees or whatever. And so, dasavan, learn, another one is dasavan. That means service, full of service, not only for the guru, but service to everyone. We are servants of everyone. In different ways. Of course, we render service to humanity too. We render service to the other devotees. We engage in loving exchanges. According to Srila Rupa Goswami, isn't it? Dadati prajagranati guniyam akyati prichati mukte bhoshite chaiva. Giving gifts, accepting gifts, loving exchanges with other devotees and with people in general. And we go out there. Actually, I just read a statement by someone who wasn't a devotee. He said, I've never met a stranger. I've only met people that I haven't met before. I've only met friends that I haven't met before. Can you imagine? That's a nice statement, isn't it? That you say, I've never met anyone who is a stranger. I've only met people, friends, that I haven't met before. It's wonderful. So is a dasavan. So these are the qualities of a disciple. Of course, the actual Sanskrit for disciple, shisha, which comes from the root, shash, which means discipline. In other words, you're disciplined by using your intelligence to manifest these qualities. And so that's a disciple. Of course, we can use the word obedient, but most of you don't like that word. That's a bad word nowadays. You know, if you say to someone, you should be obedient, then someone will say, what do you think, I am a dog? Because you have a dog, you have obedience training. You understand? It's like, at least in English, when you hear this word obedience, you just want to, like that, you picture someone going like that, like a dog. So we don't use certain words like obedience or, even the word master is kind of hard for people nowadays, you see. He is my spiritual master. Therefore, we just say guru. That's politically correct. Because originally in the Vedic culture, in India, the wife would call the husband Swami, which means master. They don't do that anymore, I don't think. They just say, hey you! Where's the money? But it's true. I mean, it's such a nice culture because the wife would say to the husband, Swami or Prabhu, and the husband would call the wife Priya, which is actually very sweet. Nowadays, they just use their names, which is not as sweet a relationship. So anyway, so there are certain terms that in presenting Krishna consciousness we may want to be careful about using. So we just say the spiritual master facilitates the devotee's Krishna consciousness, which is true, rather than saying the spiritual master is the boss, which is not really true, because Prabhupada said blind following and absurd inquiries are to be condemned. So we don't want blind following. One has a right to ask the spiritual master. Any other questions? Yeah.
One instruction, Prabhupada is very much touching me. He said, ISKCON is a society to be independent from outside help, producing our own grains, our milk, and is my second phase. So related to that, then how much it is important today, and how much we can in the modern society implement the natural qualities of our character?
That's a good question. I mean, I haven't seen that done so much in the Western world for a variety of reasons. I mean, talking specifically about farm communities and people producing like that. And, of course, we have Alitanath and Dandaniti who are growing all their own food right here in the middle of the city. Pretty good. I mean, Alitanath told me he has all the vegetables from here. He even had some left over from last year. And he learned a way to, which I'm going to go look at after the class is over, how to store things in the ground so they'll last a long time. He puts these big concrete pipes in the ground, you know, deep in the ground, and then puts the vegetables and they stay there. It's like having what we call a root cellar. And so, that's actually a very good example. Ultimately, it would be good to have functioning farms. The problem with the Western people in farms is that most Western people are lazy. And then we don't want to get our hands dirty. We don't want to start digging the ground. We'd like to go to the supermarket. I mean, even I do a lot of preaching in country outside of the United States and outside of Europe. I was in Fiji, which is part of my area of responsibility. And we were in one of the islands out there. Fiji is mostly with the Indian culture there. So we were out of one of the islands, and we were supposed to take one of these small planes to go somewhere else. And the plane was late, and it was breakfast time. And it was Sunday. So I said to the devotees, you know, what are we going to do for breakfast? And they said, well, the supermarkets are closed. And this is a tropical place, remember. And I pointed to a banana tree. I said, what's that? And they said, it's a banana tree. And I said, what grows on it? And they said, bananas. I said, pick some. And then we looked at a papaya tree and did the same thing. What grows on it? Oh, papaya. Pick some. And it's interesting, they would let the fruit rot on the trees, even in a tropical place where people, you know, anything grows, you know, mangoes, papayas, jackfruit. Because you don't know what jackfruit is. But they make sabji out of it. It's very nice. Anything grows, but they would prefer to go to the supermarket and spend money. Because God forbid they should climb a papaya tree to pick some papayas. Or get dirty picking some bananas. And it's in certain places, in India it's like that too. People moving to the cities, isn't it? And then they buy things in the supermarket, working uber-economic jobs. Because, you know, working on the farm is hard. I've very rarely seen someone who gets adjusted to city life able to go back to a farm. You know, it's very, very rare for me to see that. Well, here's one of our acharyas here. We're just talking about you. Talking about farming. So, Like in most of these countries here, the Western European countries, also America, you import people to work on your farms. Like in America, it's the Mexicans. you know, in Western Europe and Germany, it's the Polish people, Czechoslovakian people, and other people from Eastern, some of the Eastern European countries, more East. Haven't you seen that?
Yeah.
Like, who does the farming here?
They have machines.
They have machines.
Polish people, they...
Yeah, the Polish people. And who does most of the heavy construction work here? Polish people?
Romanians.
Romanians. It's interesting, isn't it? The more so-called advanced you get, the lazier you get. And Prabhupada also said that modern technology increases unemployment. So unemployment means that people just sit all day long, you know, with it, behind a computer screen, doing useless work. People go to business school to learn how to manipulate money, how to invest or whatever they do. It's all unemployment. I mean, we're meant to be out there in the fields, most of us. I'm meant to be out there, isn't it? With our hands, getting the hands dirty. You know the nice thing about getting the hands dirty? You get a lot of vitamins from that. Did you know that? You didn't know that late enough. Vitamin B12 comes from the microbes in the soil. And when you're handling it, it comes in through the skin. I would guess, if I did a blood test on all of you, most of you would have vitamin B12 deficiency. I would almost guarantee it. Most devotees have vitamin B12 deficiency. And guess what other vitamin you get from working out? Vitamin D. You know vitamin D? It's called the sunshine vitamin. Vitamin D moderates the immune system. So when you have enough of it, you don't get allergies or colds that much. And nowadays, people are getting so many allergies. I mean, one of the recent most prominent allergies is a peanut allergy. It's serious. When I was young, we would eat peanut, tons of peanuts. Nobody ever died from peanuts. Nowadays, there was some story, some girl ate peanuts, kissed her boyfriend, and he died. True, it's a true story. So you don't find peanuts on airplanes anymore. It's true, you heard that story already. I mean, come on, the kiss of death. I was killed by a peanut. What would you say at that person's funeral? You know, poor John, he died from peanuts. So, but that's because of lack of vitamin D. All these allergies that people are getting, all these problems. Lack of vitamin D. It means they're not outside. They're inside all day long. They're not getting sunshine. They're not getting the microbes from the soil. Their food is very artificial. And the food's getting more and more artificial. I mean, you're worried about GMO food. But the latest thing is they're taking 3D printers and printing food. You heard about that? They're taking the chemicals, putting them into a 3D, you know what a 3D printer is?
Yeah, they make weapons.
You make guns from them. But they're taking the chemicals and putting them into the... And the 3D printer is printing a pizza. True. I'm not just making this up. So not only will you not have agriculture in the future, you just be taking pills or having you know, putting your computer on, let me print me a pizza tonight, or print me a... whatever you're going to... print me a pakora. And print me some sweet rice tonight. So, the things are getting really crazy. And people are living in the city. In modern industrialized countries, a very small amount of people are on the farm. You know, 2-4% on the farm. In India, it's more and more people moving to the cities. And a lot of the farmland is just laying there. And that, you know, then the GMO food, which in the beginning gives more production, but at the end causes more problems. And so that's modern science, because people are too lazy. And we find that, you know, because our devotees come from the general populace. You know, if I go around the room, who here is going to move to the farm? Probably you only have one person, Litanath, Dhananiti, who moved to the farm. Everybody else, you know, we like having our mobile phones and computers and... I remember the first time we had a farm in ISKCON, it was New Vrindavan in the United States. And the devotees, Prabhupada said, simple living, high thinking. So the devotees were thinking, you know, we need to have a washing machine to wash our clothes. But there was no electricity. So, and the farm was way up on the hill. There was no way to get there except for walking. So the devotees were carrying this big washing machine up the hill. And they forgot there was no electricity. They were carrying it up the hill. And Prabhupada was laughing at them and saying, Ugra Karma. You know the story? He was laughing. He says, Ugra Karma. You know, just like unnecessary, too much work, crazy work. And so they were carrying it up the hill just because they didn't want to wash their clothes in the stream. But Prabhupada wanted that simple living high thinking. You know, we plow the land with oxen or organic things. But has it really happened in the West? Not so much. I can't. You know, Hungary, they're doing a lot of nice work there. But in general, I can't think of any farms that we have in America, for example, that are really functioning on the basis that Prabhupada wanted them. Because we're all lazy. Including me. I'm not finding fault in anybody. We're all, you know, we're just used to this easy life. Turn on the hot water. Isn't it? In the old days, when I joined the movement, there was no hot water. Nowadays, you go into the bathroom after the brahmachari is taking a shower and it's all steamed up. What temple was I in? I was just in a temple. Oh, yeah. I was just in a temple where it was like that. I visited, I forget which temple it was I was in, but I went to the temple and I couldn't see myself in the bathroom because there was like a steam bath inside. Brahmachari had just taken a half hour shower. But in the old days, this is in New York, you had no hot water and you just turn it like needles piercing your body. But you still had to take a shower. And you get adjusted to that austerity and you get to like it after a while, isn't it? Prabhupada said that should be the training in Gurukula too. How the children should enjoy austerity. But we're somehow or other addicted to a more comfortable home, why we need beds and everything like that. I mean, just like one time I wanted to just sleep on the floor, you know, and the disciples wouldn't let me sleep on the floor. Yeah, I took my mattress and threw it away and just put a blanket on the floor. I want to live like this. And then next I walked in, there was a bigger mattress on the floor. You know, space age foam. You know what space age foam is? It's a type of foam that memory foam. Anyway. So just like you can't even be austere if you want to. So what's the speak of going to farms where you have to wake up early in the morning? You know, milking cows? Anyone here ever milk a cow? You have to wake up early in the morning and you know, in the natural farm you don't put machines on the cow and suck out the blood and everything like that. You have to talk to the cow, rub it down. I remember the first time I milked a cow, I didn't know how to milk a cow. Because the person who was supposed to milk the cow left without telling me. So the devotee said, the cow has to be milked. And I said, okay, I'll do it. So I went out there and said, here I am. And I put the bucket down. Where's the milk? And then I figured I had to, you know, milk her. But then she knew that someone who didn't have any experience was doing it, and she didn't let the milk down. So I said, come on, where is it? And finally, it took me about an hour rubbing her down, and you know, with a warm cloth, and just saying, you know, everything's all right, I'm not a demon. And finally, I was able to milk the cow. But anyway, so it's hard. You know, you gotta get your fingers real strong and everything like that to milk the cow. And you do it twice a day. You do it early in the morning when you want to be in the temple room chanting Hare Krishna. 7 o'clock in the morning, then in the evening like 5 or 6 o'clock. Farm life is not easy, but it's very satisfying. Because you really feel in touch with Krishna and nature when you're doing it. But to answer your question, most of us are too lazy to do it. We'd rather be in the cities. So we should do it. But let's see. Maybe when there's some shortage in society, more people will do that. What do you think? Maybe, or maybe they'll just starve. Where's the food? Like those people in Fiji. There's no food. Even it's growing on the trees. Yeah.
And somebody told me actually they got the opportunity to get oil rigs and didn't want it because they had gotten used to life around it. They thought it was much better than be dependent on the oil.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, that was when Russia cut off the oil to Cuba. Yeah.
I heard people also tore up parking lots and started planting trees instead.
Yeah. Yeah, small gardens like that. I mean, you can grow in a small... How small is your plot?
200 square meters.
And you could grow enough to feed your whole family.
Yeah.
Not a big family.
No, but it's like you can feed a whole family. Normal persons, the two of us together.
You can feed a whole family on that.
You could feed like 5-6 people on that for a whole year. And have stuff left over. Pretty good, isn't it? And all your vegetables have come from that, right? So how much money? You've probably saved a lot of money, right?
20,000 a year.
20,000 a year saved.
Not dollars, not euros.
Oh. Alright. It's still good. Okay, I was thinking you were talking about euros. But, you know, it's still good. I know, no, if you have to buy organic, how much would it cost a year?
Something like that. Pretty obviously. You know,
same, but... And you're eating healthy food. You know what and even the organic food that you buy, I'll tell you a secret. It has chemicals in it. The reason it does is because they take, you know how they fertilize in the organic farms?
They take manure from farms and...
Manure from regular farms.
Slaughterhouse.
From the slaughterhouse waste. And they take fish and they grind them up. So you're eating something that's basically a product of violence. To a certain extent. I mean, you can't help it. But. So, I mean, you grow your own. I mean, that's what Prabhupada wanted. Very simple. And you don't have a tractor or anything, right? Your hands. He's just using his hands. Can you imagine that? A shovel, you know, though. All right, so minimum mechanism and maximum manual labor. And you feel good. It gives you... You don't get sick that much.
No,
plenty of vitamin D. So, look, here's an example. Exactly. Like recently we've been doing a study of, to help devotees, like how to increase the lifespan of devotees, because we see a lot of devotees dying young from different lifestyle diseases. So one of the common things where you have groups of people around the world, they're called blue zones. Anyone's ever read the book Blue Zones? No. Where you have these zones of people who live like over 100, a large percentage, is the people who are working out in the fields. That's one of the common things. There's many other factors too, but they were, and they eat practically no meat or extremely little meat. They're vegetarians. So it's a very healthy life. But we would rather work in the city and just have all the modern conveniences. Anyway, there's a place to be in the city. I mean, obviously, if you have service for Krishna, you belong in the city preaching. So any other questions or comments before we end? Yeah.
I read that in the Life of Devotion, unless you take initiation, then you're not really connected with Krishna. But still, Krishna consciousness can be quite ecstatic.
Yeah, well, in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it says that holy name does not wait for initiation. So chanting the holy name, whether you're initiated or not, you're connected with Krishna. However, if you want to become an absolutely pure devotee and reach the perfectional stage, you've got to follow the process outlined by the acharyas. And one of those aspects is taking initiation. That's it. But it's not that you're not connected with Krishna. Because even if you chant Hare Krishna one time, you're connected with Krishna. Even Namavash, you're connected with Krishna. That means you're meaning something else when you're chanting or joking or making fun of someone. You're still connected with Krishna, but if you want to chant purely, come to the stage of Shuddha Nam, then part of the process is to accept a bona fide spiritual master. All right, I think we should end. I'm going to go look at the garden now. Not that I'll become a gardener, I'm too lazy for that, but at least I'll eat the fruits from the garden. That's the advantage of being a sannyasi. Like in the Bhagavatam it says, was that the sannyasis are like the person who keeps... A person who keeps bees. The bees all do all the hard work and he goes and collects the honey. You ever hear that example? That's from the Bhagavatam.
They call
Madhukar. Yeah, a type of sannyasa is called Madhukar. Yeah. Madhukar means like a bee who goes around, honeybee, goes around and takes the pollen from different trees. Okay, thank you very much. All glories to Sri Ramayana Gaurishila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai, Gaura Premananda.